From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, sectarian violence broke out in Lebanon. Backers of the Shiite opposition, led by Hezbollah, clashed with government forces in the worst internecine bloodshed since the end of the Civil War in 1990. And there was violence directed at the media. Hezbollah supporters attacked the building of the Al-Mustaqbal newspaper and broadcast headquarters, destroying equipment, routing the employees, and knocking the TV channel off the air. Journalists and human rights supporters rallied to protest the attacks, which they said struck at the heart of a vibrant free press unique in the Arab world. Rami Khoury is editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Lebanon and a professor of public policy and international affairs at the American University of Beirut. Rami, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Tell me exactly what media outlets were hit and who was doing the hitting.
Well, the Mustaqbal, the Future TV, was the main one. They also hit the newspaper of the same name, Mustaqbal, or Future newspaper. It was very narrowly and clearly targeted. These were symbols of Saad Hariri, who's the son of the assassinated late Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, who took over as the leader of the Sunni Muslims of Lebanon. And he's one of the leaders of the pro-government group and one of the foes of the Hezbollah-led coalition. So they targeted his media more of an attack against him and his movement rather than, I think, a complete assault against the mass media.
Now, we should point out that in Lebanon, while its press is freer and more vibrant than almost any place else in the Middle East, excluding possibly Israel, most media outlets are affiliated with one political faction or another. In that context, it's easy to see why a media operation would be a target for interfactional violence, no?
Well, that's true. But just to correct one point, I would say that the Lebanese press is even more open than Israel, because in Israel you have strict military-related censorship, security censorship by the state. You don't have that here in Lebanon, and it's open here to the point of being chaotic. But each TV and radio and newspaper and magazine virtually is an arm of one of the political groupings, and a few of them still even get funding from overseas, from other Arab countries. So this makes the media extremely ideological.
You're editor-at-large at the Daily Star, where there was a very nuanced editorial on the violence, and it pointed out that, yeah, the various media in Lebanon are very ideologically skewed. On the other hand, the very free media marketplace is one of the things that Lebanese should most cherish about their society, and it's crazy to put that vibrant free media at risk for some sort of perceived political advantage. Do you think Hezbollah was chastened by that editorial?
I kind of doubt it. I don't think an editorial makes much difference to them. But I also think that they were not trying to reverse the liberal, open atmosphere of Lebanon. They were going after media outlets that were owned by one person. The media simply became a symbol of the Hariri movement, of the pro-Western, pro-American movement. And they've come back. I mean, they're back on the air now, which I think Hezbollah expected. But I think it's important in a wider sense that we wrote this editorial and other people were out in the streets demonstrating, supporting the Future TV and newspaper to make sure that they come back and that we don't have any more attacks like this, because the open media is one of the hallmarks of Lebanon. And of course, Hezbollah is aware of this because they take advantage of this. They have a very dynamic TV station, Manar, which is watched all over the Middle East. And it's extremely ideological, even propagandistic. They are able to do that because Lebanon is an open system.
You described the attacks on the Al-Mustaqbal as a message sent to the pro-government Hariri family. But I've also seen it explained as a response to the government's shutting down of a telephone network that Hezbollah had used for its own purposes. Can you tell me about that telephone network and what exactly happened there?
This phone system they have is part of their security network. And when the government took the decision to stop this phone system, Hezbollah reacted very strongly. That's what triggered the fighting in Beirut and the political crisis.
Well, if nothing else, this episode makes clear that Hezbollah isn't just a few young people at a checkpoint with AK-47s, but it's very much a state within a state with its own infrastructure. Part of that infrastructure is the Hezbollah TV station Al-Manar. And I wonder how Al-Manar covered the attacks on Mustaqbal.
I didn't see the actual TV coverage of the Mustaqbal building attack. They covered everything in the prism of their role as a resistance group that's defending Lebanon, that's opposing Israeli attacks, that's opposing what they call the American project for hegemonic control of the Middle East. And Hariri does the same thing. If you look at Mustaqbal TV, they say that this gang of thugs, Hezbollah, which is an agent of Iran, threatened the dignity of Lebanon and attacked. And what happens is that people tend to watch the media they like.
I want to end this by coming back to that Daily Star editorial I mentioned earlier. I called it nuanced, but I'm wondering if it also could be called naive for asking everybody to agree that attacks on the free media are out of bounds. Isn't it more likely that given everyone's ideological affiliation with one faction or another, that the media will just be the new battleground?
Well, I think you're probably right. I mean, it is fair to call it naive, but at the same time, it's very principled, and it's very representative of much of what Lebanon is, that there are people who do insist on certain standards of morality, of political principle, of freedoms, of conduct, whatever you want to call it. Asking for media freedom and media professionalism and integrity is just one example of that. I mean, there are citizens want this kind of behavior. They just haven't been able to mobilize themselves as citizens to be able to impact on their political class and the ruling elite. That hasn't happened yet, and that's one of the great frustrations in the country.
Rami, many thanks.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to do it.
Rami Khoury is editor-at-large for the Lebanon Daily Star. Not far from Beirut this week, another message was sent, this one to the Israeli Knesset by President Bush.
As we mark 60 years from Israel's founding, let us try to envision the region 60 years from now. This vision is not going to arrive easily overnight. It will encounter violent resistance. But if we and future presidents and future Knessets maintain our resolve and have faith in our ideals, here's the Middle East that we can see.
As the New York Times cheekily observed in its coverage of the speech, the president was so bereft of optimism for what remains of his administration's role in the peace process, he was forced to imagine 6 decades hence. But if the administration is looking well beyond January 2009, so too, it seems, is the White House press corps. As Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank observed in a recent column, the briefing room is feeling lately like something less than the center of the universe. The other day, in fact, it was half empty.
It was a little bit exaggerated on Monday because, as I had written, it was the deputy to the deputy to the substitute to the deputy to the original White House press secretary. So there was slightly less interest than usual, but it's kind of hard to measure since there's almost no interest at any point anyway right now. It's basically one big nap room at this point.
And is that because there's other stuff going on, like the Democratic primaries, or is it because the president has been relegated to irrelevancy?
Yeah, there seems to be some sort of a presidential campaign going on, and there's various traumas around the world. But the fact of the matter is people would tend to be assuming that the president isn't playing a very large role in the life of the nation. So it's not unique to this president. I remember the same sort of thing happening in the last year of the Clinton presidency when he was battling to be relevant. But it's particularly pronounced now. You know, when you have 28% support in the polls, they're not going to take you very seriously up on Capitol Hill. And, you know, unless you're bombing Iran or something, they're not going to pay a lot of attention from the press corps either.
Well, I want to come back to Iran in a second, because I guess there's a risk that while the press is not paying attention, we could end up in a war in yet a third country. But I want to come back to a character you had mentioned in one of our previous visits, and that's Raghubir Goyal.
Yes, he's one of my favorites.
He's the representative of an Indian-American publication. And you had told us earlier that he is often called on by the president during a news conference when he wants to change the subject. On Monday, Where was Goyal?
Well, the Goyal foil is how he has typically been used. Goyal was speaking to us Monday from the seat of the New York Times. It was, I believe, Cheryl Stahlberg's turn to be there that day. She might have had something else to do, like her laundry. So Goyal was resplendent in a sparkling silver jacket. He took over that chair.
Like moving up to the box seats in the ninth inning of an 11-4 game.
It is something like that. You know, the interesting thing about Goyal is not even they represent a small news outlet. It's not clear that that news outlet exists altogether, and many people have tried to find a hard copy or find it on the web. He is apparently its sole employee, and apparently his main job is sitting in other people's chairs in the press room and asking questions.
Okay, now I want to come back to what I was getting to earlier, which is the idea that although the president is a lame duck and he will leave office in late January, that's still 8 months from now, and there's a lot that could happen. Is there a risk that the media, or at least the White House press corps, is taking its eye off the ball?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, let's consider what the president was doing that day. He had two events on his schedule. One was a Cinco de Mayo dinner, and the other one was Cinco de Mayo entertainment. Following the dinner, he added in a late event. That was he met with the Beagle that had just won the Westminster Best in Show. The press is very naturally responding to that. You're not going to be doing wall-to-wall coverage from the North Lawn of the White House if he's meeting with Uno the Beagle.
All right, Dana. As always, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Dana Milbank is a reporter and columnist for The Washington Post. Coming up, the anti-meth movement zeroes in on Montana and South Dakota. This is the media. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Remember this?
This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
It's a memorable campaign, but you could argue that many curious teens did still have questions about drugs, questions they answered by frying their own brains with cocaine, heroin, aerosol propellant, or whatever. Since then, crystal meth has re-entered the underground formulary in a big way, ravaging countless communities, especially in western states. Its extremely addictive properties make it a particularly important drug to warn teenagers from trying, and so the Montana Meth Project was launched in 2005 to do just that, using print, billboards, television, and radio ads like this one.
I had sex with guys for money. I had sex with guys for meth. I'd do anything to get drugs. I could pretty much sell any part of my body and it'd be okay if I got high later that night. My name is Zelda. I'm 16. I'm from Elmo, Montana. I started doing meth when I was 13.
Meth Project Executive Director Nitza Zupas says the ad campaign has worked.
When we first started in the state of Montana, half of the male prison population was there because of meth. 65% of the female prison population, half the child care cases were because of meth, and we were number 5 in the country for meth use. Today, Montana now ranks number 39 for meth use, down from number 5. So that's a 70% decrease in adult meth use. And if you look at this relative to our benchmark states like Wyoming and South Dakota, who adopted just as stringent pseudoephedrine laws at the same time as Montana, their meth use has gone up 6%. Wyoming's now number 3 in the country. South Dakota's up 8% and remains number 16 in the country.
There's one spot that shows otherwise ordinary kids so under the thrall of the drug that they do a home invasion robbery. There's kids abandoning a friend who's having a seizure, just throwing the friend by the entrance to a hospital emergency room. Extremely disturbing. But disturbing, historically, has not necessarily been a guaranteed way of getting through to young people who tend to think of themselves as invulnerable. Why did you go in this direction?
So the way that we approached this campaign was much like you would, approach a consumer marketing problem where, the consumer is the teen And what we wanted to do was make sure that teens knew exactly what that product was. So we spent a lot of time listening to teens about what they thought and felt about methamphetamine, about anti-drug advertising, about general advertising, and what they thought would work. You know, we learned the first thing we needed to do was have someone communicate with them that they could relate to. So what you'll see in the TV ads is we start with someone who, you know, could be them, and then show the decision and then the outcomes. The other thing that we learned in the market research was there were lots of things that kids thought were cool about methamphetamine, which is a really scary prospect. You know, 44% before we started the campaign saw great benefit in using the drug. 24% said they saw little to no risk, and 66% said it was readily available. This is one of the most highly addictive, destructive drugs, and they think it's no big deal to try, and people are offering it to them.
It is well documented that teenagers are consuming less and less of traditional media, and they're even watching less television. So it must be a challenge in the first instance just to reach your target.
What we do is develop a plan to make sure that we reach, on average, 70 to 90% of teens 3 to 5 times a week through a combination of avenues. The internet, TV, radio, billboards, near schools, near shopping malls, and then in terms of the print, you know, high school newspapers, you know, posters in the schools, things of that sort, to make sure that, you know, we are reaching kids where they are.
Now, earlier I made reference to a spot about a home invasion, but in some sense, all of this advertising is a kind of home invasion because it just shows up uninvited on your television or on your radio. Have you had complaints from those who really, for all the problems with drug abuse in Montana, really don't wish themselves to be assaulted in this fashion?
Yeah, you know, we learned a lot. We continue to evolve the campaign and certainly have mistakes that we learned from. Initially, when we launched the campaign in Montana, we had the advertising on throughout the day. And we very quickly learned, basically in the first day, that's really not appropriate when, you know, some parents just sit their small children in front of the TV as a babysitter and these ads come on. We shifted the media campaign to start after 7 p.m., which is entirely appropriate. Before we launched it in Montana, we were, wondering what kind of public response there would be because it is a very difficult subject. And the effects of this drug are very disturbing. And we had thousands of people, you know, come out and support the program. The public response was just really, truly overwhelming.
Well, Nitza, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nitza Zupas is executive director of the Meth Project. With a third of California speaking Spanish, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger offered his Spanish-speaking constituents some advice.
You've got to turn off the Spanish television set. It's that simple. You got to learn English. I know that when I came to this country, I did not or very rarely spoke German to anyone. And my heart was always in Austria, but I wanted to, as quickly as possible, learn the English language.
Yeah, if they didn't watch a word of Spanish language television, they probably would learn English quicker. But former LA Times reporter Joe Matthews says they'd miss out on the best local television news. After comparing the English broadcasts to the Spanish each night, Matthews concluded it's no contest.
I discovered just a much more serious, in-depth content on the two Spanish language newscasts, the Univision affiliate, CAMEX, and the Telemundo affiliate, KVEA. There was actually more coverage of what I would sort of consider the basics of news, state and local, government, broad issues, healthcare, immigration. And on the English language stations found...
Car chases, Lindsay Lohan, and is your toaster strudel poisoning you? Stay tuned.
The greatest example was while the KVEA Telemundo 11 o'clock newscast was taking a strong look at the Iraq war and real estate foreclosures, you were getting stories about spas you can go to in the middle of the night on the English language stations.
I saw a bumper sticker once that said, I'm not a vegetarian because I love animals. I'm a vegetarian because I hate plants. And It occurs to me that TV stations don't put trivia and fluff on because they hate news. They do it because they love audience. Is it that the Spanish language stations haven't figured out yet that they'll get more audience by having less substance? Or is the Spanish speaking audience more attracted to news than their Anglo counterparts?
There is some argument that they are more attracted to news. They're also getting better ratings. I mean, the local news audiences in English are in decline, but KVA Telemundo station was actually growing, and the Univision local newscasts at 6 and 11 are really top in the market ratings-wise. At 6 p.m., they've been one or two for years. So Sirius News seems to have built a better audience.
In the print press south of the border, a lot of it is so tabloidy and graphic in a police gazette sort of way, with dead bodies of drug kingpins splashed all across page one. I would have thought that that kind of "if it bleeds, it leads" mentality would have found its way to Spanish language television in Los Angeles.
When you talk to the folks making the decisions of what's news on these shows, they say their audience has a very small interest in that. But on many of these nights of the 6 weeks I looked at, if there was a very big crime story, you would see it on both English and Spanish. But the difference in how the stories were covered sort of shows the philosophy. In the Spanish language broadcast, you see many more people interviewed, and not just crime victims, but folks affected. A lot of questions asked about police conduct and police response that you never see addressed. What's the reason for the difference? If you compare Mexico and here, you're talking about a much broader audience down there than here. I mean, and the kind of folks who will cross a border and move away from family and home, it seems possible to me it might be a bit more serious-minded.
You found much more substantial programming on Spanish language television. You did not find perfection. There are some issues like the cleavage factor. Tell me about the darker side of Spanish language television.
Well, particularly on Univision, some of the blouses on anchors are pretty darn tight. There's a definite element of sex to sell. There have been a number of serious ethical transgressions, most notably the political reporter and a weekend anchor for KVEA. Mirthal Salinas was the mistress of the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa. As the story came out, we learned that she had dated the Speaker of the California State Assembly, Fabian Nunez. This was quite a scandal, and I think it's one of the few things that sort of the English language media consumers know about Spanish language news. There's also the issue of advocacy. I mean, there's really strong advocacy in the journalism that, I wouldn't, as a recovering newspaper reporter, only out of the business for 2 months, I wouldn't have dared tried. But that's part of the philosophy. Executives at both Telemundo and Univision say that's part of what drives our audience. And you've seen it most strongly in this national debate over immigration legislation, where you've got people on the news telling you basically to show up for marches, or at least how to. But the good part of the advocacy is it seems to be driving these stations to look at more serious social issues, subjects that no one else has covered.
Do you think over time the Spanish language broadcasts are inevitably going to just get worse?
No, actually. I think the Spanish language media has an enormous competitive advantage, I think, by covering the news. When you talk to the folks in this, they want to do more of it. They're adding newscasts. They're adding bureaus. They're adding reporters. I mean, I think the real question is what happens to English language news. I've heard from a lot of English language TV news producers and anchors since the story ran in the Washington Post, and not a one disagreed with the premise, and many talked about their frustration with what their networks have done. There are a lot of great local news reporters who work in English in this town. And I hope actually that the competition from Spanish language will force the English language stations to be more serious.
All right, Joe. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Joe Matthews is an Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. In this very long election season, with all its primary night facts and figures, exit polling has become a key part of covering the race for all of the networks. That's why ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox News, CNN, and the Associated Press are suing South Dakota over a law that forbids them from doing any exit polling within 100 feet of a place where people vote. The networks say the law violates their First Amendment rights and assures the inaccuracy of their polls. South Dakota Secretary of State Chris Nelson argues that exit polling can intimidate voters or even change their vote, especially if they hear exit polling as they're entering a voting place. We're going to hear from both sides of this debate, starting with Secretary Nelson, who says that on primary day, June 3rd, those who violate the law will be duly punished.
The statute that requires the 100-foot barrier is a criminal statute. If it's violated, the way it would be handled is a precinct official would tell the exit poller, hey, our state law requires you to be 100 foot away from the polling place. Please move out to that area. And if the exit poller, you know, refused to do that or continued to encroach upon that, that's where law enforcement would be called to deal with that. Very similar to how we would deal with any incidences of campaigning too close to the polling place, any of those kinds of things that we have on the books to maintain the decorum and the integrity of the polling place.
How would being polled as you're leaving the voting booth interfere with the integrity of the voting process?
If the presence of that person in any way intimidates people from coming into the polling place, or if they're literally talking about candidates, pro and con on the various candidates, that kind of thing going on, you know, close to the entry of the polling place or even within the polling place, that could have an effect that we would not want.
Have you gotten any reaction from the people of South Dakota about this law and the enforcement of it?
Yes. Literally 100% of the response that we have heard on either me personally or reading various local blog sites has confirmed that the people would like to see that 100-foot area upheld. And typically the comments run along the lines of either, you know, we as citizens don't want to talk to exit pollers, so, you know, keep them away from us, or we just don't like exit polls, period.
One final thing. In the past, the South Dakota primary has come along at a point when decisions had long since been made. There wasn't exactly a media stampede. Does the fact that there will be a greater onslaught than usual in any way affect your decision to step up enforcement of this law?
No, not at all. And you know, I'm a little puzzled by the comment that we're stepping up enforcement. This is really no different than we've done in every other election. You know, we have a set of guidelines for conduct at the polling places that is passed out to our election workers. The election workers are trained on how to properly enforce these guidelines. That is no different this year than it has been in the past.
All right. Mr. Secretary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Nelson is the Secretary of State of South Dakota. Dave Tomlin is the Associate General Counsel for the Associated Press. Dave, welcome to On the Media.
Pleasure to be here.
This law has been on the books in South Dakota since 1985. Why sue now?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I guess the biggest one is that although the law has been on the books, our exit pollsters have been able to operate within that distance, and we assumed that the same would be the case this year. But we were advised by the Secretary of State's office that they intended this year to strictly enforce the provisions of that law.
Now, we just spoke to the South Dakota Secretary of State, and he was quite adamant on the point that the law has been enforced, at least that personnel at the polls have been trained to enforce it.
Well, that's not the information that we have. Obviously, I'm not going to second-guess what his people have told him, but this, in previous elections, it hasn't been an issue for us. This litigation is expensive. It's a six-figure exercise to attempt to challenge one of these laws. If South Dakota and its primary were not playing the role at the end of the train in this particular election, we probably wouldn't be litigating this year, but we need to do it.
100 feet is a third of a football field, but it's also a significant figure in the exit polling business. Why is that?
When you're taking an exit poll, there's a very strict routine that the pollsters follow for picking the voters. As the distance from the place where voters come out increases, it disrupts the process of selecting the voters, and that in turn results in gaps in accuracy. And that problem has been documented time and time again by the exit polling firm.
Now, you mentioned that it's not inexpensive to litigate these things, but you have done so in the past. How has it turned out?
We were victorious in all three of the earlier efforts this year in Ohio, in Florida, and in Nevada. Courts understand exactly why exit polling is core political speech of exactly the sort that the First Amendment is supposed to protect, and that states cannot unreasonably control it.
All right, Dave. Thank you very much.
Glad to do it.
Dave Tomlin is the Associate General Counsel for the Associated Press. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. If you've been following this year's presidential campaign closely, you might have picked up on a new phrase that's worked its way into the candidates' speeches and into reporters' coverage, namely green-collar jobs.
People know about white-collar jobs. They know about blue-collar jobs. But the idea of green-collar jobs is something that folks are just beginning to appreciate.
The potential for creating green jobs that can not just save on our energy costs, but more importantly, can create jobs in building windmills that will produce manufacturing jobs here in Ohio.
Green technologies, we can create thousands and millions of new jobs in America.
What the candidates haven't gotten around to explaining yet is what exactly green-collar jobs are. Is this another case of verbal greenwashing? Freeloading on the feel-good vibes from the environmental movement without doing the actual legwork? I posed that question to Phil Angelides, the chairman of the Apollo Alliance. His group is leading the charge for a clean energy revolution in America. Members of the alliance have consulted for both the Clinton and Obama campaigns. Phil, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you.
Okay, now green-collar job is a term that I hadn't heard until pretty recently. I know what a white-collar job is and what a blue-collar job is, but green?
When we talk about green-collar jobs, we're talking about jobs that provide wages and benefits that can support a family, jobs that give the opportunity to build and advance a career, and jobs that go to work to increase sustainability in this country, protect the environment, and fight global warming.
Do I understand that a green-collar job is basically a blue-collar job in the economy and the industries built around environmental sustainability?
It also can include white-collar jobs that are turning with a green tint. But a lot of this is about using our existing skills, building off our existing industries in this country to create a wave of jobs that improve the environment. In this country, each year, about 3% of our buildings are either newly constructed or substantially rehabilitated, which means by 2030, 75% of the buildings in this country are either going to be new buildings or substantially rehabilitated. That's about 325 billion square feet of buildings. Now, buildings and energy consumption in buildings account for about 40% of the carbon emissions that we put out in the United States of America. If we embark upon an ambitious program to make existing buildings more energy efficient, and we adopt tough new standards for efficiency in new buildings, we can not only combat global warming, but we can create a wave of hundreds of thousands of jobs for skilled workers in this country, making our built environment more efficient.
I want to get back to the term green collar. Others are using it as well, but not necessarily in the same way. Can you tell me, has the meaning of green collar mutated? Has the term been abused?
This year, particularly in this presidential year, this has been the real debut of the word and the notion in the larger public consciousness. I mean, it says a lot about where we are in this country that certainly the two Democratic candidates for the White House and to some extent the Republican candidate are speaking about green collar jobs. It shows that there's an emerging consensus that this is an important path to be pursued for this country. Obviously, I think what we have to guard against is greenwashing when it comes to the use of green collar jobs, where for promotional purposes, people talk about the creation of green collar jobs that, you know, pay substandard wages that really don't have the right kind of effect on the environment. So I think we have to stay true to the movement as we develop public policy.
Because some guy sorting cans from bottles and earning $7 an hour may be part of the green economy, but is probably not that thrilled about it.
Substandard wages is not our goal here. And I think that what we need to hold everyone's feet to the fire is when we're talking about green collar jobs, it's the twin notion of building real strength in the backbone of the American economy, which is jobs for middle-class families, working families, and cleaning up the environment, because that's really going to be our ticket to success.
Is this just another phase we're going through where we are embracing green consciousness, and when the price of oil goes down, it'll all once again just be forgotten?
I believe we've passed the tipping point. I think that people see the imminent threat of global warming and believe it. I think we see in consumer attitudes a new desire to have products and services that are more environmentally responsible. The reality is that you're right. We've gotten previous wake-up calls and have not responded. I don't believe we have the option this time.
All right, Phil. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so very, very much.
Phil Angelides is the chairman of the Apollo Alliance. So, green-collar jobs are good and are the answer to what ails our economy. But the Apollo Alliance's is only one definition of what green collar means. Russ Juskalian, a freelance reporter for the Columbia Journalism Review, has been following the evolution of the term. Russ, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We just got finished talking to Phil Angelides of the Apollo Alliance about green collar jobs, and he defined it. But is there a universally accepted definition of what constitutes green collar anything?
I don't think there's really agreement at all on this. It's all over the place. Is the guy who works for the construction company who is putting out concrete and building foundations for big buildings who, you know, one job happens to be putting up a foundation for a windmill. Now, is that person's job a green collar job? In the campaigning in the Rust Belt, Hillary at one point said, you've heard white collar jobs and blue collar jobs. We're going to create green collar jobs. And what that means in reality is something that never really got answered.
Is anyone doing the due diligence to figure out whether, for example, Barack Obama's promise of spending $150 billion over 10 years to create 5 million new green jobs?
Right.
You know, if that is actually a practical plan?
I haven't seen a lot of good analysis in the press whether that is going to work or it's not, and what it means if it does work. Are those 5 million jobs over 10 years, is that going to make any kind of sizable difference in terms of lost manufacturing jobs or many other factors in there? So no, I don't think that we've seen a really good analysis of that, which is what we'd like to see.
You agree, though, that the term green collar can be a very useful way to convey the whole notion of an economy built around environmentally sustainable measures. Your quibble is not with the term per se, right?
No, but how it's used. And at a certain point, it's a matter of somehow deciding, are we talking about just blue-collar jobs that now have an environmental twist to them? Or are we talking also about, you know, lawyer jobs or accountant jobs that are also tied to the environmental movement? And I think that's important just in terms of having a conversation so we can agree what we're talking about.
Well, I can certainly foresee a case where some, I don't know, electric utility is burning the softest, most sulfurous coal and spewing all sorts of crud into the environment and actually putting green shirts on its employees and saying, well, these are green collar jobs.
And using phrases like beyond petroleum or something like that. Yeah, you can definitely see that. I mean, this is this classic greenwashing issue that we've heard about a lot in other areas. And now it's just one other aspect of it is this green collar work.
The term green collar is out there and useful or not in play and useful or not likely to be abused. What do you tell the press, either following the candidates or an environmental reporter? What advice do you give when they're about to type those words into a story?
Well, I think that the press has the same kind of pitfalls as everyone else when it comes to this green stuff or environment stuff. It sells and it's fascinating and we're all kind of primed to be paying attention to it. So if they can have a really amazing headline, people are going to pick up the magazine, the newspaper, whatever it is. And yeah, at a certain point, there's a judgment that has to be made, or to say, look, we're not willing to say whether this is good or bad, but let's raise the question and raise it in a way that people take note.
All right, Russ. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Freelancer Russ Triskelion writes for the Columbia Journalism Review. Last month at 6th and Pennsylvania Avenue, overlooking the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., the second generation of the Newseum opened its doors. The brainchild of the Freedom Forum, the Newseum is a seven-story, $450 million celebration of the First Amendment and of the 2.5 centuries of news and opinion it has yielded. I spent a day there recently and brought back this.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press.
That's James Madison reading the First Amendment to the Constitution. I mean, not the real James Madison, duh. It's an actor all dressed up to look founding fatherly in one of the 15 theaters and close to a trillion video screens here, designed to make our freedoms come alive.
This is an educational experience, but it's also an entertaining one.
Former USA Today News executive Joe Urschel is executive director of the Newseum.
One of our most popular galleries is actually our restrooms, where we've posted some of the most egregious bloopers that newspapers have made in story content and in headlines.
Yep, here's the part where I make fun of the Newseum, which is like shooting fish wrapper in a barrel. For starters, please note that the sacred artifacts of journalism deemed worthy of preservation and public display, Rupert Murdoch's desk phone, Peter Jennings' mouse pad, Wonkette's slippers, even massive concrete slabs of the Berlin Wall, whose claim to relevance is not instantly clear, because it was in all the papers? Then there's the sheer scale of the place. Its 800-square-foot atrium TV screen, its 250,000 square feet of exhibit space, its $500 million price tag, and $20 ticket price, all of which stand in ironic juxtaposition to the incredible shrinking industry it celebrates. Yes, it would be easy to conclude that as a central curatorial concept, scale is what the place is all about. This is from the welcome video.
Here's a fun fact. These elevators are the tallest hydraulic lift elevators in the world.
Here's a fun fact. I don't care. Never mind. On to the 4D movie, because 3D is evidently one dimension too few for the Newseum.
Here you will travel through time, a stowaway on the greatest journey of all times to make news. Our destination? The eyewitness reporter on the scene. The recorder of history in the making. Prepare for time travel.
Prepare for time travel and also your theater seat wiggling electromechanically to simulate the real-life thrills and spills of press freedom.
Holy mackerel, I'm inside a printing press and it's moving.
I wasn't the only one that was impressed. I shuffled out of the theater just behind the lacrosse team from Oratory Prep of Summit, New Jersey, whose members thought deeply about the greatest journey of all time.
3.5 and a twist. No, I like 3D and a twist.
Yeah, it's easy to find fault with this place, and I got in for free. This may explain the sneering that has gone on in our cherished free press. Joanne Ostro of the Denver Post called the Newseum a grandiose vanity project. Slate's Jack Schaefer said it was a gilded disaster, and Andrew Ferguson of the Weekly Standard said the place is preening, pretentious, and absurd. But you know what? Not so fast.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting.
And to say that somebody is about to land on the moon and walk around on it while almost everybody on Earth watches is just about too much to swallow.
Tonight, See It Now devotes its entire half hour to a report on Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, told mainly in his own words and pictures.
And all around the common paddy field that feeds these hamlets, a ring of fire. 150 homes were leveled in retaliation for a burst of gunfire. If there were Viet Cong in the hamlets, they were long gone.
Vietnam, Watergate, the moon landing, McCarthyism, those are just some of the extraordinary moments in our national history, documented by the press and preserved here. Not only is it fascinating, even a bit nostalgic, to relive them via telescreen replay, these are pretty poignant reminders of journalism's watchdog responsibility in a democracy. Elsewhere in the 250,000 square feet, there are other reminders of journalistic daring more poignant still. An armored vehicle used by a Time magazine correspondent in Bosnia. It's shot up with bullet holes. The Datsun in which Arizona Republic reporter Don Bowles was murdered by a bomb that ripped through the floorboards. And the camera equipment, notebooks, and IDs belonging to Bill Biggert, salvaged from the wreckage of the World Trade Center. ABC's Charlie Gibson narrates the video at that exhibit.
Bill Biggert died when the second tower collapsed. It was his friend and fellow photographer Chip East who helped recover his camera gear and the pictures he had taken.
From the last picture shot, as the dust comes across him from the South Tower falling,
does the museum, as Jack Schaefer alleges, fetishize artifacts? No. As it turns out, the museum displays them, leaving you to ponder what messages a smashed camera or a pair of slippers might convey. Even the slabs of the Berlin Wall, bare on the eastern side, graffiti-covered on the western, are profound metaphors after all. They are about the power of news. Joe Urschel.
You realize that the Berlin Wall was able to imprison people within their own country, but the wall was not able to stop information from coming in over and around the wall.
Oh, it's easy to understand why the critics rolled their eyes. Journalists tend to react viscerally to pomposity and self-congratulation. But they also tend to be just too cool for the room. Maybe this is not the time or the place to be self-effacing or blasé. Our civil liberties, not least press freedom, have been under assault for 7 years by a government that doesn't respect them, with the acquiescence of a population that seems not to fully understand what, in the name of homeland security, they are surrendering. Maybe at a time like this, a measure of bluntness and self-congratulations and breathtaking scale is just what the doctor ordered.
If it weren't an overriding principle, we wouldn't have put the 45 words of the First Amendment in 50 tons of marble on the front of our building. We're trying to make that message clear without any degree of subtlety whatsoever.
So, if it's a bit hokey that they dress to pretend James Madison up in breeches and a wig, that's okay, because the visitors who have spent $20 for a ticket sit there and listen.
The Bill of Rights includes the First Amendment, which, with 45 words, forbids government interference with certain fundamental freedoms.
Oh, look, there's a teenager. Perhaps she'll say something stupid I can ridicule.
What if I said to you that the freedom of the press is what makes our whole democracy work? Do you think that makes any sense?
Yeah, because it gives people the freedom to actually let other people know what's really going on.
What if I criticize the government? How's that work for you?
Well, I think that they've been doing a really good job on having the press really get deep down into the news.
I didn't lecture Justina Brummel that the press largely sat on its hands in the run-up to Iraq because she was a first grader at the time. Anyway, I had to get to the 4D movie. When the rats crawl on proto-investigative reporter Nellie Bly in the sanitarium back in the 19th century or whatever, they also electromechanically crawl all over you in your seat. Gross! Also, I gotta say, except for, okay, actual democracy, pretty much the coolest thing ever. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Nadia Zonis, and Alan Smith. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Sasha Evans and Addie Rolnick. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.